Too bad that we couldn't generate more interest for this today. Welcome to the Moeller Lecture on Christian and Politics. As you know, this chair was established by Reverend Walter H. Moeller, who's a 1935 graduate of Concordia Theological Seminary in Springfield. Our guest lecturer today comes, as you well know, with very impressive credentials for his task. He's currently director of the Center on Religion and Society in New York, editor not only of its report, but also of the Lutheran Forum Letter. Reverend Richard John Neuhaus, who's published extensively and lectured throughout the world, is frequently quoted in both the secular and religious press. He's received many awards, including in 1982 the Faith and Freedom Award from the Religious Heritage Foundation of America. He is a 1960 graduate of Concordia Seminary. My personal contacts with him go back 15 years or more, when we had several interesting conversations personally and by phone with reference to the theological issues confronting Lutheranism at that time and Christendom. He's here today to address us, of course, on a different topic, the citizen, the church, and the public square, rethinking the twofold kingdom. In his book, The Naked Public Square, he says, among other things, the public role of religion will not be decided by a few defeats or victories in specific elections or policy disputes. It will be decided in large part by the capacity of various religious leaderships to liberate themselves from their captivity to political partisanships. It will be decided by religion's ability to help reconstruct a sacred canopy for the American experiment. We didn't need that to whet our appetite. Please welcome Reverend Richard John Neuhaus.
I thank you, Dr. Barth, all of you. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. To be in these halls of Concordia Seminary is for me an extraordinary experience. And I would not hide from you a moving experience, for of these halls, the cliche is mandatory, really. They are hallowed halls for me and for thousands of others. And they will remain that, despite the difficulties that all of us keenly appreciate, resulting in the fact that it is the first time that I have been back to Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, my alma mater, I still insist, since the recent unpleasantness, as our Southern friends refer to the Civil War. And I have, over these years, as I trust has not escaped the attention of some of you, been insistent within the larger Lutheran family that the linkages not only with the hallowed halls, but with the venerable tradition of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, must not be broken. Must not be broken for Missouri's sake, but also must not be broken for the sake of us who are moving now into the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I do not think that there has been a time in the last 100 years, at least, of American Lutheran history, in which so much has been up for grabs in terms of what it means to be a Lutheran Christian and a Lutheran church in this society. Missouri Synod will continue to bear, in my view, and I will continue to urge this upon others, a large part of the responsibility, for it bears so large a part of the gifts. for defining that distinctively Lutheran future for all of us. A future of confessional vibrancy, theological integrity, of ecumenical daring, of sacramental depth. Now, as you well know, I'm sure whoever was responsible for inviting me here well knew that there were some risks involved and that I might even say something that could just edge up to being controversial. And so let me say two things about my concerns and my hopes for the Missouri Synod, as I continue to call all of my brothers and sisters in the ELCA to continue to take Missouri very seriously and not to succumb to the temptation, which is there strongly felt, to simply write Missouri off. But within this context, here in these hallowed halls, I would say to you that I would hope that Missouri will play its role, its critical role, in the ecumenical front, in rethinking its ecclesiology, which I take to have been the nub of the problem in the recent unpleasantness, but of course that is another lecture. Especially in ecumenical dialogue, it is not worthy of Missouri to be simply a naysayer. What is required of Missouri, what the tradition of Missouri equips it to do, is to engage, to argue, to elevate the level of theological discourse and integrity. On another front, as I look at Missouri, it concerns me that with such rapidity, or at least it seems to me all of a sudden, that this passion, this mania, this obsession for church growth seems to have been seized upon by so many who have, or at least so it appears, have lost another way of defining the nature and mission of Lutheranism in America. It is very much as though, when we are not entirely sure about the gospel to be proclaimed, that we become more enthusiastic about the religion to be peddled. Obviously, there are many permutations within what is called the church growth movement. And there are many, and people whom I respect, who say that it can be advanced and framed and practiced in a way that is conditioned and shaped by Lutheran confessional integrity. And I would like to hope that they are right, but I do not think the evidence is very compelling at this point. And the evidence of the contrary is very disturbing indeed. Let me quickly add that it is not only in Missouri, but also in large sectors of the ALC and LCA merging into the new church, so-called, that the same problem is apparent. Well, having relieved myself of all that, let me get to the subject at hand, which I promised to talk to you about, and try to keep my promises. Religion and politics have always mixed, will always mix. The only question is, in what ways and to what ends, and with what consequences for the integrity of both religion and the political process. For it seems to me that we are to be concerned for the integrity of both. While there is no doubt, or should be no doubt, that in the ordering of our loves and loyalties, our commitment to the Christian community comes first, always first. It is precisely part of our Christian commitment that we accept responsibility for the civil community, or at least so it seems to me. And when we look to the civil community in the United States, which is so very often quite uncivil, we discover at this moment in American history an extraordinary degree of confusion, of puzzlement, of fear, of genuine terror on the part of many people about the ways in which religion and politics are interacting. Religionized politics, politicized religion. And we are uneasy about both, and well, we should be. And yet the interaction, what the Supreme Court might call the entanglement, excessive or otherwise, is inescapable. For politics is by definition a moral enterprise. By a moral enterprise, I do not mean obviously that everything that happens under the rubric of politics is good or right, but rather it is an enterprise that inescapably engages questions that are moral in character. What is just? What is fair? What is equitable? Etc. We learn more about politics and our political responsibility, we Lutherans ought not hesitate to say, from Aristotle than we do from Paul. And from Aristotle we learn that politics is at its very heart this, the process in which free people engage one another in deliberating the question, how ought we to order our life together? That's what politics is about, addressing that question, how ought we to order our life together? And the ought in that question is clearly a moral reference, inescapably so. And that is what I mean when I say that politics is a moral enterprise. Politics obviously can be discussed and analyzed in many other ways, as simply a process of technical management, as a matter of countervailing interests, contesting for advantage, as a rather cynical battle over the getting and keeping of power. And all of these other ways of thinking about politics and analyzing politics, all of them have a strong element of truth, no doubt about it. Politics is also all of that. But politics at its heart is the process of deliberating the question, how ought we to order our life together? Therefore, politics in any culture, in any context, is a moral enterprise, but it is much more the case in a democratic context in which presumably political legitimacy is derived from the will of the people, we the people, deliberating that question, how ought we to order our life together? The connection between politics, morality, and religion, in a more explicit way, becomes particularly intense in a society such as the United States of America, in which we profess to be, and indeed are to a large degree, a democratic polity, albeit a Republican representative democratic polity, but in which, in addition, and this is the distinction that makes America so dramatically different, that leads people to talk about American exceptionalism in world historical terms, in America, the linkage between morality and religion, going the next step, is so intense and apparently incorrigible. The overwhelming majority of the American people, when asked, from where does morality come? What is the source of moral truth? The overwhelming majority give a religious answer. That is, they will say, the Bible, the Ten Commandments, the teaching of the church, Sermon on the Mount, whatever. Now, you and I may be skeptical to the point of cynical about that answer that survey research data and opinion polls demonstrate is given by, say, upwards of 85% of the American people. I mean, after all, it's not terribly impressive at one level when people adamantly insist that morality is derived from the Ten Commandments, and the same people cannot name three of the Ten Commandments. And it's very easy to take a rather jaundiced view, therefore, of this sociological phenomenon of the linkage between morality and religion. But it would be a great mistake to do so. It'd be a great mistake to do so, I believe, to dismiss this as being superficial religion, inconsequential, unreflective, non-committed. No. First, it'd be a mistake because it is not nice to make fun of what other people claim to be their deepest convictions, and we shouldn't do that. But more importantly, it'd be a mistake because whether or not the answers such as these that people give in response to survey research efforts, whether or not those answers are reflective, informed, deeply thought about and thought through, they are nonetheless the answers given by the people who constitute the we, the people, from which this democratic polity derives its legitimacy. So it is an important social and political fact whether or not we respect its theological or ethical substance. That's an important distinction, I would suggest to you. In understanding America, we are talking then about this extraordinary social and political fact that people believe intuitively that politics is a moral enterprise, morality is derived from religion, and that therefore in some sense, in some odd sort of way, the separation of church and state, a principle to be warmly and fervently affirmed, cannot mean...
Is there a glass of...
Yep, something around. Cannot mean the separation of religion from public life or religion from the public arena. For if it is taken to mean that, and unfortunately a great many Americans think it does mean that, and frequently they have been supported by some court decisions, including decisions of the Supreme Court. If it is taken to mean that, then we are fast being led toward what in social theoretical jargon is called a legitimacy crisis, that is, in which the sources of democratic legitimacy are going to be severed from the governmental process. And this is one aspect of what I have called the naked public square. The public square, the public arena, denuded of the vibrant beliefs, myths, stories, convictions, aspirations of the we, the people, who are the font of democratic legitimacy. This cluster of problems regarding religion and politics is going to become more severe in the years ahead rather than less severe. Not least of all, because America is becoming, by all the evidence available to us, a more religious, not a less religious society. This has come as a great surprise to the cultural elites.
Thank you so much.
Of the United States, and indeed to most of us who were educated by them, simply because the assumption has been for 200 years since the secular enlightenment that as modernity progresses, so also will secularity. That is to say, the assumption which has held almost dogmatic status in the minds of Western civilization is that there is a necessary connection between modernity and secularization. And that as people become more educated, more reflective, more critical in their consciousness, read more enlightened, inevitably they would become less religious. That assumption that therefore, because the United States is the most modern society, it will inevitably be the most secular society, that assumption has everything going for it except the empirical evidence. All of us were educated, I'm sure, already in high school, for it is in every textbook, it is a generic line from high school through graduate school, that America is or is fast becoming a secular society. And so one reads, you recall, having read it, I'm sure, that such and such a problem in the past was addressed in religious terms by our grandparents or whatever. But that is no longer possible today because we live in a, quote, rapidly secularizing or secular society. It simply isn't true on the basis of the evidence. Now, this is not necessarily good news. It is interesting news that modernity, especially relative to religion, has not turned out the way the apostles of modernity thought it was going to turn out. At least it hasn't in America. And to the extent that America is, in the phrase of some social philosophers, the lead society in world historical change, it is highly doubtful that the dogmatic assumption of a necessary link between modernity and secularization is going to be working out elsewhere either. Now, as I say, this is not necessarily good news, for we Lutherans ought not have to be told that religion is not necessarily a good thing. It is as riddled with ambiguity and the demonic as any other aspect of human life. But it does tell us something about the long-term character of the questions now engaged in American public discourse regarding the relationship of religion and politics. The collapse of the secular Enlightenment, that is a broad and general thesis. I realize a rather sweeping one, but I would be prepared to defend it, that what we are witnessing today is the collapse of the 200-year cultural hegemony of the secular Enlightenment. We are witnessing it in social science thinking. We are witnessing it in philosophy with the reassertion of an understanding of truth and its relationship to tradition. We are witnessing it in the hard sciences, where more and more the best, if you will, the most enlightened thought, impels us ever closer to wonder and away from the kind of reductionist rationalism which once was taken to be the replacement of religious faith and an enchanted universe. The world is becoming enchanted again. This is not necessarily good news. It opens up a Pandora's box of all kinds of charlatanism and magic and shamanism of all sorts, none of which are to be welcomed by Christians. But it does tell us again about what kind of world in which we are and the way in which we are going to be carrying out our deliberations and our debates in the public arena. The awareness that something different was happening, that something surprising was happening, the culture shock of this for the elite culture in our society came a little bit in 1976 with the candidacy of Jimmy Carter. And you had, presumably, the leading experts on American society in My Fair City, all shaking their heads and wondering, what is this talk about born-again Christianity? As though it were some exotic linguistic quirk from some faraway tribal tradition in God knows where. And then, of course, with the emergence in 1978-79 and its very public emergence in the election of 1980 of what is called the religious new right, the culture shock became ever more severe. And there were many people who said that this was a blip on the screen, it was some kind of glitch in the American process, and if you just be patient for a little while, it'll go away. There were others who said, as a friend of mine and Reform rabbi friend, you know, when he saw the Jerry Falwells and the Tim LaHayes and Ed McAteers and so forth, who's going to put the animals back in their cages, was his question. And that sounds very crude and maybe even cruel, but it's understandable, for again, people were educated to believe that this is not the way things were going to go in the modern world. We were educated to believe that, symbolically speaking, in 1925 with the Scopes trial, that something had been settled once and for all. And that when the brilliant, scintillating, cutting wit of Clarence Darrow drove the bumbling, sweated, senile, plagued William Jennings Bryan from the witness stand in Tennessee, that world we were taught to believe, our textbooks teach us to believe, that world was finished, dead, done in, once and for all. And for almost 50 years in American life, that world, the world of the what were then just called the fundamentalists and what their cultural despisers called the fundies, the rednecks, the Ku Kluxers, the rustic yahoos, they didn't go away. They didn't take their signal. They were in the wilderness. They knew they were in the cultural wilderness. They knew they were despised. But they built upon their isolation and their being shut out, and upon their resentment, their anger at the establishment. And they built piece by piece little empires, schools and communications empires, until the little empires began to look, at least to those who were frightened by them, like a big empire, maybe even like an evil empire. And then in 1980, they came back into the public arena. And everybody was greatly alarmed, or almost everybody, at least everybody who was anybody and understood what America is all about and who were certified as experts on American life. Such people were alarmed. And the religious right, religious new right, as it was then called, was a little embarrassed, quite frankly, by the suddenness, the rapidity of its new entrance into the public arena, and utterly puzzled by the fact that within a matter of a year, 18 months, the New York Times and Harvard could be scared by them. As Ed Dobson, a fundamentalist friend of mine, an aide of Jerry Falwell's, once said, it rather reduced our respect for the New York Times and Harvard. And of course, there are still lots of people in American life who believe that this insurgency, this rough and rude crowd that knocked down the door and entered into our public square, that they will go away or can be driven away. And so we have groups like Planned Parenthood and People for the American Way and ACLU, and you see their ads all the time. It has been to them a great money-raising bonanza, a powerful scare tactic to raise the prospect of these racist Yahoo rednecks getting into their bedrooms and everywhere else and establishing a fascist dictatorship. These people are not going to go away. We shouldn't want them to go away. They are our fellow citizens within this liberal democratic experiment. Nor is it simply a question that they should be tamed and tempered and co-opted and taught better manners so that they will get along with us as we continue to conduct business as usual. No. Something new has happened. An insurgency has taken place that is not going to go away and that will press more and more intensively in the years ahead. We have barely begun to see it. The implications of what it means for politics to be a moral enterprise in which everyone, including those who have a religiously grounded understanding of the common good, will participate freely in debating the question, how ought we to order our life together? And their joining that debate is going to change that debate. It has already changed that debate. And in my view, the change is a salutary one. It is to be welcomed. It is at times, admittedly, rude and rough. It is at times, admittedly, rather raucous. But then democracy is a raucous process. It always has been. It has never appealed to the aristocratically elegant. There is something a bit sweated about the American proposition. And when it is vibrant and the people, we the people, are honestly deliberating about the ordering of their life together, it tends to become a bit more sweated. People do work up a sweat about these things. And that's probably good. That's what the experiment is all about. Now, granted, people can work up a sweat in ways that are genuinely disturbing when they believe that their participation in the public debate is to be equated with divine intervention in the public debate. And that becomes a little worrying when groups such as Christian Voice put out a Christian scorecard. That is worrying. It is worrying not because they are going to bludgeon their way through with a kind of sanctified bulldozer and run over everybody else and win all their points. That's not why it's worrying. It's worrying because it trivializes the gospel. It's worrying because it runs the risk of discrediting the Christian presence and Christian witness in the world by so closely associating it with a specific agenda for social and political change. And let it be said that it is not only Christian Voice or other institutions on the religious right. It is by no means only those institutions that sin in this regard. For they are but imitating, and most of them are quite explicit about this. They have set out to imitate and have successfully imitated and indeed have trumped the example set by left of center liberal Protestantism in American history, who equally are egregious in their presumptuous, indeed, I would say blasphemous identification of their understanding of the policy specifics that will advance the common good, of equating that with the will of God itself, and of writing out of the community of Christian commitment, or as they put it, the constituency of conscience, those who disagree with those policy specifics. What a presumptuous thing to do. What a blasphemous thing to do. And what a sad thing to do when it imperils the integrity of Christian witness in our public life. So, those Christian groups, right, left, center, and unspecifiable, that have entered with greater vigor and truly have worked up a sweat about participating in the question of how we ought to order our life together, are to be commended in many ways, but they do not need so much our commendation as I think they need our cautions. The questions facing us as a society, and given the influence of the United States of America for better and for worse in world history, the questions facing us are much, much too solemn to let them be reduced or trivialized by the pushing of our partisan particulars in the public arena. The great question facing us, it seems to me, is whether our civilization, whether this society, and indeed, I'll make it broad and say Western civilization, is capable of public moral discourse anymore, or whether we have become a culture in which every moral statement is, as Alistair MacIntyre and others have argued, simply a statement of preference. That is to say that when I say you ought not to do that, or you ought to do this, all I'm really saying is I prefer you not to do that, or I prefer you to do this. In which case your answer is, that's very nice, I prefer otherwise. And we call that pluralism. But it is not pluralism at all. Pluralism is the genuine engagement of disagreements and differences of consequence. What that is commonly called pluralism, is the monism of indifference. It is pretending that our deepest disagreements do not really matter. And thereby we are not really engaging one another. We are simply living in a deadly silence regarding those questions and aspirations and beliefs that are precisely most important in asking the question, how ought we to order our life together? The stakes are very high. We have seen what has happened in what is undoubtedly the single most fevered, the single most painful, the single most perduring question that joins public policy and religiously based moral judgment in American life, which of course is the question of abortion. And here let it be said, how great has been the contribution of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And how important the bond with our Roman Catholic and evangelical brothers and sisters, which can be strengthened, which has been strengthened, but which can be further strengthened by virtue of understanding what is at stake in the debate over Roe v. Wade. What is at stake in the debate over Roe v. Wade is about as elementary a question as you could ask. I don't think the question is, when does human life begin? That question is answered quite apart from moral deliberation, it seems to me, by an exercise of clear reason and scientific inquiry. The question is, who belongs to the community for which we will accept common responsibility? In short, the question is, when we say we the people, who do we mean by we? And if we define out a large class of what is unquestionably human life, in one form or another, how is it that by the same criteria by which they are excluded, other classes of unfulfilled or unmeaningful or only potential human life are not also excluded? This is sometimes called the slippery slope argument. I make no apology for believing in the slippery slope. Indeed, let me put it more precisely, I do not believe in the slippery slope. It's not something in which I have to make an act of faith. If there is no slippery slope, why all those cultural and legal and behavioral skid marks all over the last 50 years? We were there, and then we were there. We were arguing about this, and now we are arguing about that. We were arguing about extreme instances of threat to the life of the mother, liberalizing abortion laws, and then we were arguing about not abortion anymore at all, because we had abolished abortion law as such. And so we were arguing about infanticide and about euthanasia and about whether even food and drink should be supplied to those who no longer have any purpose in living. And who will make these decisions, and how will we define motherhood and fatherhood, and what does it mean to be a surrogate, and what does it mean that we rent women in order to bear babies, and what does it mean that we buy shares of babies by contracts upheld by the courts? We are moving into a world in which, sisters and brothers, we do not have to worry about being charged with being alarmist about the slippery slope, or in which we do not have to exercise our imaginations as Orwell did. We have simply to read, not necessarily the signs of our times, much more modest than that, just the daily newspaper, and see the skid marks. And in a society where certain technologies become available and where certain restraints are abandoned, what we must ask ourselves, is to prevent anything that is technologically possible to do, that the law can be contrived to legitimate the doing of it, and that it is in the interest of the powerful and the wealthy to do it, what is to prevent its being done? Unless there is a community in which it is possible for people to say, no. In the name of God, no. In the name of the common good, no. In the name of human decency, no. Now, the solemn question is, do we live in a society in which this community, such as it is, called we the people, or the various communities that constitute the community, even the community of the church, is any longer capable of giving a public reason and making a public argument for a moral judgment, for saying no, for pointing to a more excellent way than the way that we are presently going? I am not at all sure. See, Alistair McIntyre may be right. My friend Stanley Hauerwas may be right. Some of these people, I'm sure you're familiar with their work. They say it's over with liberal democracy. They say that what has long been the case in theory, going back to Locke and Hobbes and who have you, namely that society is simply an individualistic, liberal democratic society is simply an individualistic proposition in which individuals calculate their interests and enter into utilitarian contracts with other people. That's always been the theory, according to one way of talking about liberal democracy. And what McIntyre and other people like that are saying is that now all the chickens have come home to roost and the theory has overtaken the practice. There is no longer enough virtue. There is no longer enough customary law. There is no longer enough popularly based and entrenched understanding of moral right and wrong in order to prevent the theory from working out its inexorable logic. That is their proposition, and maybe they're right. Nobody can prove that they're not. Only the future will tell. I have to hope that they are wrong. And I would urge others to hope that they're wrong and to work toward the demonstrating of it. To work for the reassertion, for the rediscovery, for the revitalization of that dimension of the liberal democratic, the American experiment, which was premised not simply upon calculating contract between self-serving individuals, but also upon something like a covenant, something that partook of our understanding of God's providential concern for his creation. We Lutherans have no monopoly on the intuition that underlies the so-called two kingdoms doctrine, or I would prefer to say the twofold rule of God. That understanding, the intuition behind it, is there in Augustine, it's there variously in Thomas, it's there in Calvin, it's there in ideas of natural law, it's there in ideas of general revelation as distinct from special revelation, general grace as distinct from saving grace. We Lutherans have no monopoly on that insight. But I think we do have a particularly well-honed theological way of arguing that within the Christian community. And beyond the Christian community, we are well postured to recognize the integrity of the civil, of the common good, of civil righteousness in its own right, under God's rule. Not left hand of God in the sense of unimportant hand of God, but terribly important to God. For this is the world that he so loved that he gave his only begotten Son. And so to enter into the public arena with a sense of religiously motored urgency, but no illusions about our political engagement being salvific, to enter into the public arena knowing that the big questions have already been dealt with by God's justification of the godless, and that the worst threats have already been faced. The worst thing that could possibly happen already happened on a certain Friday afternoon outside the gates of Jerusalem. And knowing that those big questions have been dealt with, we can then, with a degree of freedom, including freedom from illusion about what can be done in politics, move into the public arena as moral actors, unapologetically moral actors, and as moral actors informed by the Christian tradition. And yes, if you will, as Lutheran Christians, and make the argument, whether it be with respect to how the community is defined in terms of the aged and the unborn and the crippled and the other so-called expendable, whether it be in terms of defining and articulating the purposes of democracy and its role in the world over against the threats of authoritarianism and totalitarianism, whether it be in terms of the debate over our responsibility for the poor in our midst and how do we incorporate them, the homeless in the streets of New York and of all the other streets of the country, into the community that says we the people. Whatever the debate may be, we may enter into it with a degree of freedom and even with a degree of lightheartedness, because we know the great issues of justification by grace, the great issues of the fulfillment of the destiny of the creation, the great issues of the keeping of the covenant by the one with whom the covenant is made, that these issues have been taken care of. We can, with the very wise Dr. Johnson, who of course was not a Lutheran, but perhaps if he had the opportunity, who said how small a part of all that human hearts endure can laws and kings either cause or cure. Very wise. And there are those who say, well, but you're putting down the importance of the political task. No, no. It is precisely in order to encourage us and to free us to enter without illusion into the political task that we need to relativize the political task. I would not put it down at all, for I think that this American society is not God's chosen people, and it's not in any theologically meaningful sense the Christian nation, and it's not the light in the hill. But it is something a little like Lincoln's intuition about an almost chosen people. It is something of an experiment that is not untouched by providential purpose, if we believe that God still lives and works and rules in history. There is no guarantee that Alistair MacIntyre and others are not right. The jig may be up. And what John Courtney Murray, the great Jesuit theologian and social philosopher, called the American proposition, may have just been discovered by Roman Catholics and Lutherans in this society in time to see it die. That's possible. But I don't think so. And I think we have a deep, deep stake in hoping that is not the case. For there is a sense in which, in the providential purposes of God, according to the orders of creation and preservation, that this country is, within the context of all the possible ways of asking and answering the question, how ought we to order our life together, that it is not only for us, but as a portent for the world, what Lincoln called it, the last best hope of earth. Thank you.
Ordinary time is up, but I want to remind you that Pastor Newhouse will be at Lober 1 this afternoon between 1 and 2 o'clock to in a more informal session to meet with any and all who are interested. We will take just a couple of questions now before adjourning this particular segment. Please.
On the question of rebuilding or reconstructing the so-called sacred canopy, what's the church's mission? Well, I think the church is, and this is not so much a theological answer as a political sociological answer, but it has its theological correlates. But the church's role in the United States is to give substance to the otherwise rather inchoate and unexpressed and unformed and unarticulate religious and moral aspirations of the people. And so, for example, when in the Pledge of Allegiance we say that this is one nation under God, a relatively late addition, 1954, during the McCarthy era, for not some of the most pleasant reasons it was put in there, but nonetheless very wise, I think, because to say it is a nation under God is to say it is a nation under judgment, that it is not a morally self-validating enterprise. And particularly that the state is not self-validating, but rather is accountable to a transcendent point of reference. The church, in diverse ways, the Christian community and the synagogue and other religious communities, give religious and theological specificity to what is meant by the phrase under God. There are many people, many Christians, who are nervous about that because they say, well, you're talking then about a civil religion. And that's a whole long discussion, as you know, that got started up, cranked up again in 1968 with Robert Bellah's essay and has still kept on chugging along. I am not for a civil religion. I am for the public recognition of those common symbols which reflect not a civil religion, but a multitude of religious particularities of the community of a genuinely pluralistic society. So for us as church, to fully be our particularistic self is also the greatest contribution we make to the general culture. And people who trim their sails in order to appeal to the general culture, churches that do that, I would suggest, generally speaking, not only violate the integrity of their own community, but more importantly, they contribute nothing interesting or new to the general culture, because they simply become an echo of what is already there and place at most a kind of religious gloss on options, ways of life, viewpoints, which are thriving quite well, thank you, without the church's assistance. Someone who was taping this said I have to repeat these questions, but it has to do with the Alabama case and the decision of Judge Brevard Hand that, on the evidence presented in court, that in fact the state of Alabama was violating the so-called Establishment Clause of the First Amendment by teaching in the public schools what is functionally a religion and is called secular humanism. That was the decision. There is an element of whimsy in that decision, it should be pointed out, because Judge Brevard Hand had before that, in the case of the Jaffrey case, had decided that the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment, as you know, there are these two, the Free Exercise and the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment. Judge Brevard Hand had said that the Establishment Clause doesn't apply to the states, really, because the 14th Amendment, which incorporated the First Amendment and made it applicable to the states, was something which he didn't recognize. That is, he didn't recognize the incorporation. So the Supreme Court, on that earlier case, overruled Judge Learned Hand. Not Learned Hand, Judge Brevard Hand. His enemies call him Judge Unlearned Hand. But actually, I think he's a pretty smart fellow. And in any case, so he's had this case sent back. And they said, you know, well, you're just wrong. You know, the Establishment Clause does apply. And the state. And so Judge Hand did a rather, and this is the whimsy of it, he said, okay, he said, if you want to play Establishment Clause, I'll show you how to play Establishment Clause, you know, and do it with a vengeance. So then he turned the whole thing on his head, and he said, okay, if you want to look at it in terms of the Establishment Clause, then there is indeed a religion being taught. And he had some very, very impressive testimony at this trial. He had on the other side People for the American Way and the usual known suspects. But he had James Davison Hunter of the University of Virginia, whose testimony is going to be published in This World, a Journal of Religion and Public Life, which we also publish and which I trust the seminary gets two dozen copies of. And Hunter pointed out, that of course, sociologically speaking, if you take a functional definition of religion as distinct from a substantive definition of religion, that is, what role do these ideas, these moral assumptions, whether they call themselves moral assumptions or not, what role do they play? Do they play a role of normative, providing a normative, coherent pattern and belief system for life? Okay? Well, then something like what is called secular humanism, and that is clearly contained in the textbooks, is religion. And it is being taught by the state of Alabama, and it is, given the Supreme Court's earlier definitions of what violates the Establishment Clause, in violation of the Establishment Clause. Now, there are problems with the Hand ruling. I wrote an introduction to it. It'll be published by a Washington legal think tank, and I wrote a long introduction to it. I think in the long run, it'll probably get overturned as well. But that doesn't mean it isn't a very important decision. Because what it has done is demonstrated the utter confusion in which the Supreme Court has put itself over the last 40 years, especially since the Everson case of 1947, in trying to define what constitutes religion, and therefore what constitutes free exercise and what constitutes establishment. And the Supreme Court itself, as I think even its friends, even people who agree with the decisions which have reinforced the naked public square, are generally ready to admit that the court has been totally incoherent and internally contradictory in its interpretation of the religion clause of the First Amendment. So the Brevard Hand decision, the Alabama decision, along with many other initiatives of that sort, are forcing us to a greater level of candor about the ways in which religion, morality, and political discourse interact. And to the extent that they're doing that, I welcome it.
We'll take one or two more yet, please. But
I want to follow up on that earlier question. How do you think the public square should answer the question, what kind of God do we need? We say one nation under God. In other words, what kind of God do Lutherans want the public schools to talk about?
Okay, so what kind of God do we mean when we say one nation under God? But then you put a twist on it in the end, which is a very good one. What kind of God do we Lutherans want the public schools to be talking about when they talk about God? My own feeling, and bordering on being a rather firm conclusion at this point, is that there is no good way of answering your last question. That in a pluralistic society, the whole set of assumptions behind the common school or government school or state school or public school movement from the 19th century onwards, that whole set of assumptions is no longer sustainable. That is, when Horace Mann and others launched the common school movement, there was securely in place in American life a Protestant, primarily Puritan, although watered down Puritan, set of moral, religious, and even communal, covenantal assumptions about America. And it was clear that that's what the common school or the state school was going to teach with regard to God and history and destiny and moral right and wrong. And most Americans didn't have much trouble with that, aside from Roman Catholics, against whom the common school movement was largely directed, in order, that is, to socialize and civilize these barbarian hordes of papal minions, you see, who were invading our Protestant country. And that was a very large part of the dynamic. And the continuing reverberations of that, both visible and subliminal, are still very much there. But it wasn't only the Roman Catholics. Obviously, Missouri Synod Lutherans had a very real problem with the notion that a common school or a government school could ever adequately say anything worth saying about God without saying something that was going to be terribly false by the lights of our Missouri Synod forebears, which is why we established a Christian day school movement. I don't think that we can, as a society, nor do I think we are required to, answer the question of what binding, normative, functionally religious beliefs will be transmitted in the public classroom. Because indeed, we are too pluralistic a society. Just as we don't do that with the military chaplains, we don't say, for example, that the government should have a chaplaincy to the military with a common denominator religion, which will satisfy all the spiritual commitments, beliefs, needs of the people in the armed forces. On the contrary, we take a quite different approach. We look to see who are the people there, which are the communities represented, what are their needs, and then design government policy in order to accommodate those perceived needs. So also in the long run, I expect we're going to do with regard to education. As we move toward increasing parental empowerment and educational choice, not only through vouchers and tuition tax credits and instrumentalities such as that, but also through creating greater diversity within the so-called public or government school system. And there are some very interesting experiments going on in the country, in Massachusetts, Maryland, a couple in Florida, in California, in which within public school systems, there are efforts being made to create magnet schools, not only in terms of specialized academic interests and such, but also in terms of, quote, values, in terms of beliefs, in terms of how children want their, or how parents want their children to be taught about God. Because finally, the people who must answer the question that you pose is not the churches institutionally, but we, the people of this democratic society, meaning, in the case of education, primarily the parents. And so the future of educational reform, I believe, which will also take care, at least as best we can take care of the question you put, will be through the means of parental empowerment.
When Pastor Newhouse began, he talked about possible risks in inviting him. Until that time, I felt pretty good about his coming here. Now, of course, I'm wondering, you know, what those risks might be, but I want to assure him that if there are risks, or whatever they might be, they were certainly worth it, weren't they? And he has given us much to chew on, not only in terms of our individual citizenship, but certainly also as Lutheran church people in our society, in which we want to bring the precious gospel of our crucified and risen Lord to bear upon the hearts and lives of those to whom we're privileged to speak. Our debt of gratitude to you. Thank you very, very much.